When I say an Adventist view, I'm speaking mostly as a historian. I want to understand how our world has changed, where we've come from a time where marriage was a given to a time where Dr. Pauline has said there's some question whether the younger generation within the church will still embrace our views of marriage in a few years or even today. What is it about our worldview that's changed? And so I've gone back to understand how the 19th century Adventists and other conservative Christians thought about not the issue of homosexuality, but marriage and family in relation to rights. We're perplexed. Now, I'm moving into the paper. I don't have enough copies for everyone, but if you can share between two or three of you, there are some diagrams that will be helpful in following the talk. I'm trying to answer the question as the perplexity that we face as Adventists on the civil question of same-sex marriage. Should we support traditional marriage as a moral principle important to the community? Or should we accept gay marriage, same-sex marriage, as a part of moral freedom and the separation of church and state? Help to answer these questions, I believe, can be found in the Protestant natural rights tradition and the early Adventist application of that tradition to civil rights issues of their day. These perspectives can help provide guidance today. To understand how Ellen White and the Adventist pioneers would have viewed issues of marriage and family, one must know something about the Protestant natural law backgrounds that they inherited in which they largely operated. It is this framework that provides an understanding for how they would have approached issues of same-sex marriage and religious freedom today. By its very essence, as being found in nature, natural law is accessible to all. Thus, there are many streams, schools, and views on the precise content and contours of natural law. The diversity of these views should not cause dismay, as they all agree on a central contention that there is a higher moral code to which all human acts and laws must conform or be adjudged unjust. The universality of laws against murder, theft, rape, and the like give a meaningful core to the natural law that disputes over its contents at the edges cannot obscure. The Christian natural law tradition was refocused in the late medieval West by Thomas Aquinas, the famed 13th century theologian. While Protestant thinkers did not embrace all of Aquinas' views of natural law, they generally have followed his natural law taxonomy of, and there's four elements to it, eternal law, divine law, natural law, and human law. Eternal law is the fullness of the mind of God, all his decrees and plans. And here I have a little diagram to try to illustrate the relationship of these four kinds of law. Needless to say, humans are ignorant of much, if not most, of what makes up the eternal law, which is inexhaustible and will be studied for eternity. Divine law is a subset of the eternal law in which God reveals through special revelation, especially biblical revelation. It consists primarily of those truths that human nature could not discern on its own through reason or experience, but can only be discerned through God's act of revealing. I say primarily because biblical revelation also includes teachings and truths that are part of the next category of law, natural law. So the Bible consists of an overlap of two kinds of law, divine, which is scriptural, revealed, and natural. And so I have the next slide here showing divine law as a subset of the eternal law. Then the category of natural law is where most of the disagreement occurs, including disputes over whether it exists at all, and if it does, can anything be known about it for certain. In theory, the natural law is found in the created world, most clearly in the shape and design of human nature. It is based on the idea that humans were created for certain purposes. It's not just a Christian idea. Aristotle would say to be happy, eudaimonia. Aquinas would say to reach a perfection of morals and virtues. Both men would agree that the fulfillment of the natural law would lead to flourishing of the individual and society. Both would also agree that the rules of the natural law can be understood by applying reason to human nature and experience. So here I have a slide that shows the relationship of the natural and the divine law. So the divine law says, thou shalt not kill, but that is also known through a study of nature. So most civilizations, even without the Bible, have rules against killing and theft. For Aquinas in the medieval church, human law, which is the next level, could be based on both natural and or divine revealed law. This meant that human laws could enforce not only the second table of the Decalogue, and if you think about it, the second table of the Decalogue is reflective of natural law. Countries that don't have the Ten Commandments still have rules regulating all of those elements of the second table. Those commands that overlap with morality, but that the first table, including prayer, religious ritual, and days of worship, that on that point certain branches of Protestantism took a very different approach. So here is now we add human law. In the medieval view, human law then overlaps with the eternal law, the natural law, and the divine law, including areas of the divine law that are not necessarily revealed by the natural law. Protestantism and the natural law. Early Protestant thinkers tended to emphasize even more strongly than Aquinas the obstacle that human fallenness created to both knowing and doing the natural law. Both Luther and Calvin strongly rejected any role of natural law in the formation of doctrine, as well as for playing a role in salvation. Both, however, saw the importance of the natural law in providing a guide to the laws of society. Their Lutheran and Calvinist heirs, however, often rejected notions of natural law at all, emphasizing the centrality of Scripture to an understanding of all morality. Other Christian groups, especially certain branches of Anglicanism, as well as those stemming from free will Arminianism, kept alive the importance of natural law to both the governing of society, as well as understanding the full obligations of Christians. These later thinkers expanded the tools of the natural law beyond reason to include elements such as experience, intuition, instinct, and conscience. Nearly all Protestants understood natural law to overlap, as I've earlier said, with the second table of the Ten Commandments. Even dissenting Protestant groups such as the Anabaptists, the Baptists, and the Quakers accepted that the state could enforce the moral truths of the second table. Not completely. Christ points out the spirituality of the law, not just murder, but hate, not just adultery, but lust, and that the law cannot reach those internal things. But as far as the crude outward actions, this did provide grounds for state oversight and regulation. But these dissenting groups believed that the first table, with its oversight of prayers, religious rituals, and holy days, was not properly subject to civil laws. Finally, the human law was the attempt by humanity to regulate itself through laws that reflected the principles found in natural law. While not all human law would be required by principles of natural law, human law should not violate those principles. In the dissenting Protestantism that developed in the Radical Reformation and that became prominent in 18th century America, it was believed that only natural law could serve as the basis for human law or public policy. That was the philosophy behind at least the First Amendment at the federal level and eventually at the state level, that public policy should be based on revelations accessible to all and not revelations found only in Scripture. It was natural law, accessible by shared human reason and experience, that was legitimately the basis of positive human law. This concept of shared experience is reflected in the famed words of the U.S. Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. So some people want to see this reference to Creator as, well, this is the Creator God of the Bible and we're a Christian nation. But the previous words here, self-evident, is in fact the opposite of a special revelation and is referring to the general revelation accessible to all. All persons everywhere, through the use of thought and reason, can arrive at these truths even apart from access to special revelation. So the Protestant view of the relationship among these laws is visually seen in this chart. So rather than the human law covering natural law and divine law, the human law should only cover that area that can be defined by the natural law, where the natural law overlaps with the divine law. That is the dissenting Protestant and American, early American view of public policy. Of course, in our modern era, the Protestant view of natural law is no longer influential in the public square. From the early 20th century, with the rise of German higher idealism and the death of natural law in the academy, the elite institutions have moved to a largely secular outlook, generally called positivism and legal positivism in the legal arena, where there's no meaningful relationship between human laws and divine laws or even transcendent principles. Legal positivism is the belief that all law is only what humans enact, and there is no higher authority than the legislative body or the body politic, perhaps, or maybe the court that it interprets and implies those laws, but it applies them. But that's all a human endeavor. This modern version would look something like that, right? Human law is separate and apart from all of transcendent sources of law. Of course, the true secularist would view the material on the left side of the screen as merely the construct of the fevered imagination of religious zealots, and they would limit the world of law, legal principles, and even morality to the domain of human law on the right. But even many Christians, while accepting the existence of the eternal divine natural law construct, would take a dualistic approach to the question of law in terms of civil society. These Christians would agree that the material on the left should be used for personal morality and to guide the church community, though even here many of them would be skeptical of the natural law category, believing in only a scriptural-based morality. But these dualist Christians would argue that in matters of public policy and civil and criminal law, we should only draw on the kinds of pragmatic and utilitarian concerns that we would recognize as purely human law. And in fact, in much of the 20th century, the notion of morality in law, you know, the sort of street-level phrase, you can't legislate morality, is often used and widely misunderstood, because you legislate, if laws are concerned about justice, justice is about morality. You really can't do that. What they're trying to say probably is you can't legislate spiritual or religious morality. This dualist position came to dominate, ironically, in both conservative, fundamentalist, and liberal circles in 20th century Christianity. Many conservatives denied the existence of natural law because they wanted to underscore and promote the importance of scriptural morality. Ironically, this left them with little or nothing to say in response to public policy concerns relating to morality. Liberal Christians denied natural law for separate reasons having to do with a commitment to empiricism and scientism and the supposed limits of human knowledge for non-material matters. But the overall effect of these trends was to remove Protestant voices from the shaping of American public policy for more than half a century. Protestant Americans awoke to their mistake in the early 1970s as the sexual revolution, including the nationwide acceptance of abortion, the proliferation of pornography, and the rise of divorce and gay rights, forced them to confront the products of the moral vacuum they had inadvertently helped create. Since that time, Protestantism and Adventism have been haltingly trying to find its way back into the public policy conversation. The attempt has been made quite challenging by the impoverished Protestant natural law and civil morality vocabulary. And it's very interesting, I didn't include in this paper, but in the 1890s, Ellen White said there's three things we should especially study in our schools. And the first one she listed was moral philosophy. And then she said the Bible. And then she said physical health. And Adventists read that, and they say, oh, moral philosophy and the Bible, those two must be together. Really, she's talking about biblical morality. Mm-hmm. But if you go to the 19th century and you understand moral philosophy was a term of art that meant the study of morality from non-scriptural sources. It, in fact, was the opposite of the Bible. Not in content. It wasn't meant to contradict the Bible. It was meant to supplement and complement the Bible. So we lost sight of that in being concerned about philosophy in the 20th century and dropping it as a discipline of study largely. We thus dropped our vocabulary to engage these public policy discussions about morality. So the question is, can we look back at our pioneers and understand their views of the natural law, and could that enrich our discourse today? And so here I move to just about halfway through my paper and halfway through my time. This looks like it might work. I'm proposing that Ellen White largely held to this general 18th century American Protestant understanding of natural law. She did not develop or set out the ideas of eternal, divine, and natural law in a systematic way. And often she uses some of these terms, especially eternal and divine, interchangeably. But the concepts about law that she expresses reflect generally the categories I've described above. As a church leader, she tended to emphasize the divine law, especially that found in the Ten Commandments and equated with the eternal law. She also held the traditional Protestant view that the Ten Commandments consisted of two tables that were split between duty to God and duty to man. Two mighty principles are declared, she wrote, in those ten precepts. On the first table of stone was inscribed the four precepts showing the duty of man to God, and on the second table were the six showing the duty of man to his fellow man. She followed dissenting Protestantism in insisting that the state should stay out of laws involving man's duty to God, while it should protect those principles governed by laws of natural morality. She also understood that principles found in the natural world that promoted health and wholeness, physically and mentally, were also part of God's law. Indeed, it was in describing these natural health and moral principles that Ellen White was most prone to refer to, quote, natural law. For example, she writes, quote, "He who cherishes the light which God has given him upon health reform has an important aid in the work of becoming sanctified through the truth and fitted for immorality. But if he disregards that light and lives..." An unfortunate typo there, don't I? "But if he disregards that light and lives in violation of natural law, he must pay the penalty. Not only does this natural law govern our physical being, it can be understood through the application of reason and intelligence." Again, White writes, "Men and women cannot violate natural law by indulging depraved appetite and lustful passions without violating the law of God. He has permitted the light of health reform to shine upon us, that we may realize the sinfulness of breaking the laws which he has established in our very being." Right? This is a reference to the human nature, the location of the law in human nature. "He proclaims his law so distinctly and makes it so prominent that it is like a city set on a hill. All intelligent beings can understand it if they will. The universality of the natural law does not mean that everybody already knows it. Rather, it means that, according to White, all intelligent beings can be taught it if they are willing. It involves," she claimed, "the application of reason to the cause and effect events of ordinary life. She directed parents to teach your children to reason from cause to effect. Show them that if they violate the laws of their being, they must pay the penalty in suffering. Not all will put forward that effort." I'm jumping to the end of the next paragraph. "She viewed the teaching of the natural law as part of the bridge to reaching the world with the message of the gospel for the end time." See, these are two separate things, but they're so related they need to be proclaimed together. This is a very strong quote here. "To make natural law plain and to urge obedience to it," she insisted, "is a work that accompanies the third angel's message." Very strong. "The relationship of this natural law to a conception of natural and civil rights is the concern of our next section. The correlative relationship of rights and duties." And this is what I'm going to suggest. A lot of people, even in our day, have a notion of rights, and even the notion of human rights, and maybe even natural rights. But what does that mean? This is where we are coming apart, in a sense. Natural law is not a panacea for freedom or a guarantor of freedom. In fact, it existed for many centuries without a very robust conception of natural individual rights. Indeed, certain conceptions of natural law worked against ideas of individual freedom. The natural law, as understood in the Middle Ages, created obligations rather than rights as we think of them. The only real right you might have had would be to carry out your obligation or duty under the natural law. The church hierarchy and civil aristocracy were there to tell you what your duties were. But with the growth of Protestantism and the recognition that the first table of the Decalogue created duties towards God alone, a pattern began to develop that the state should not interfere with or define these vertical duties. The priesthood of believers meant that individuals now had not only the right but the duty to study the Bible for themselves and find out from God what those duties were. The individual had a duty to worship God, and therefore had a right not to be interfered with by the state in the exercise of that duty. So duties that existed came with corresponding rights that existed came with corresponding duties or responsibilities, right? It didn't exist in the abstract just because I feel strongly about something, I have a right to it. No, the right generally flowed from an obligation you had to somebody else or to God himself, which others must respect. In a sense, the right against the state grew out of an individual's duty towards God. These duties to God and the corresponding rights against the state arose from the basic image of God in humanity. This image included reasoning and moral faculties, which could be used to discern right and wrong. All who are human had these faculties, and I'm going to jump down to the next heading. This universal human nature, with its innate duties to God and corresponding rights as against others, was also how Ellen White thought about fundamental human rights. In commenting on the Apostle Paul's comments that all humans come from one blood, she wrote, "In that age when human rights were often unrecognized, Paul declared that God made from one every nation of men to live on all the face of the earth. All are on equality, and to the Creator every human being owes supreme allegiance." Note White's emphasis on the supreme allegiance, or duty, that all people owe to the Creator. This duty to God becomes the basis, in her view, of our rights towards or against others. As she stated elsewhere, "You belong to God, soul, body, and spirit. Your mind belongs to God, and your talents belong to Him also. No one has a right to control another's mind and judge for another, prescribing what is his duty. There are certain rights that belong to every individual in doing God's service. No man has any more liberty to take these rights from us than to take life itself." So you see the correlative nature of rights and duties, and then rights against others, so those duties can be carried out. She quoted approvingly the congressional document that tied these rights to the idea of the ultimate duty of humanity to God. This wasn't just her philosophy or the Adventist Church philosophy. It was, in many ways, the dissenting Protestant philosophy on which the nation was founded. And here's a congressional document. "The framers of the Constitution recognized the eternal principle that man's relation with his God is above human legislation and his rights of conscience inalienable. They felt that their duty to God was superior to human enactments and that man could exercise no authority over their consciences." Now, from this, if rights flowed from one's duty to God, it is a kind of nonsense to talk about a right to violate civil moral laws of God, or just the moral laws of God, as described in the second table of the Decalogue. As White put it, when the divine law is set aside, the greatest misery will result, both to families and society. The French Revolution gave an example of the results which have followed a disregard of God's law: dishonesty, theft, licentiousness, drunken, and murder. And these are all obviously references to the second table. "Infidel France once tried the experiment," White writes, "of rejecting the authority of God. What scenes of horror followed? Men cast aside the divine law as a yoke of bondage, and in their boasted liberty they placed themselves under the rule of the various tyranny." And jumping down to the next paragraph, "The claim to be free from civil enforcement of God's laws, as found on the second table, is not a claim of liberty, but of licentiousness. Such lawbreakers put on swaggering airs and boast of liberty when they are slaves to selfishness, debased appetite, and licentiousness." With other Protestant law thinkers of her day, White clearly saw the appropriateness of the civil enforcement of those standards and values found on the second table. To give a couple of examples, the duties of husbands and fathers in temperance reform. Husbands and fathers had a duty towards their family, which he owed before society and God. Among these are providing material and physical support, as well as emotional and social affection. Activities and commercial services that interfered with the performance of these duties could be regulated and even banned by the state, according to this logic and philosophy. That is why White wrote and acted so strongly against the sale of alcohol. "The home of a drunkard," she wrote, "tells the sad story of the evil wrought by the use of strong drink. Wretchedness and destitution reign, and often the wife and children suffer from cold and hunger. But despite this invasion of the family unit, the liquor trade is legalized. Heaven sees it all. God keeps a record of the men robbed of their reason and the homes made wretched by the use of alcohol. This robbery of reason and the peace and safety of the home would bring judgment," White declared, "not just on the drunkard, but also on those that passed and supported laws for the sale of this destructive product. In that great day," she said, "when every man will be judged according to the deeds done in the body, what will those who have legalized the liquor traffic say in excuse for allowing these places of death to be kept open?" For these reasons, White and other Adventist pioneers involved themselves in the nationwide movement for laws prohibiting the sale and consumption of alcohol. She went as far as preaching that Adventists should go and vote for such laws and those supporting them, even if the elections were held on Sabbath, which their opponents often did to keep them away from the polls. And she got up in the pulpit and said, "You have a duty to go and vote." The state appropriately protected, now talking about marriage and divorce, In White's views, those corresponding rights and duties that produce the moral standards of family structure. Ellen White approvingly quoted Sir Walter Scott's description of revolutionary France. Quote, intimately connected with these laws affecting religion was that which reduced the union of marriage, the most sacred engagement which human beings can form, and the permanence of which leads most strongly to the consolidation of society, to the state of a mere civil contract of a transitory character which any two persons might engage in and cast loose at pleasure. If fiends set themselves to work to discover a mode of most effectually destroying whatever is venerable, graceful, or permanent in domestic life, they could have not invented a more effectual plan than the degradation of marriage. Close quote. Here, White describes the introduction of what is basically no-fault divorce into the French legal regime, a plan that she viewed as fiendishly efficient in the destruction of domestic life and society. In her mind, the domestic relations, including marriage, were relations of the second table that the state should cultivate and protect. Legal efforts to loosen the rights and duties of domestic life and to make marriage more easily separable and less permanent were threats to society itself. On the pressing issues of our day in relation to marriage and family, one need hardly wonder what White would have thought. In regards to the relatively tamer move to no-fault divorce in 18th century France, she included a quote in the Great Controversy from a famous French actress who quipped that the new marriage law was the sacrament of adultery. Given White's view of the sodomitish practices which brought the judgment of God upon the world, she would likely agree that the acceptance of gay marriage in our society is the sacrament of sodomy. While God and the civil state allow a certain freedom for people to choose moral wrongs, there is no natural right to require others to support, promote, or facilitate such wrongs. Under the framework of rights and duties that I've outlined above, one can see an argument that the state should give freedom to allow consenting adults to engage in certain sexual behaviors that don't impact others. Decriminalizing homosexual behavior between consenting adults in civil society seems consistent with the freedom that God extends humanity to make moral or immoral choices. But that is a far cry from insisting that alternate sexual arrangements have some right to demand from the state and all other citizens full recognition and support as a public, positive public good and as a place to raise children. Such claims are an attempt to improperly turn a moral wrong into a natural right and to insist that all must morally agree with it. Heterosexual relations produce children who have a claim on their parents for care and attention. The parents have a natural duty to provide this until the children can fend for themselves. In return, the children have a duty to respect and obey their parents. The state, in turn, then has a duty to respect and protect these natural, reciprocal relations of rights and duties. Homosexual relations, by their very nature, cannot produce this same natural effect. There is no correlation of rights and duties between God, society, and individuals that would make a claim truly one of natural rights and justice. That is, if the word rights or justice are to retain any sense of a transcendent claim to a moral duty to God or a higher law that must be respected and facilitated as a matter of right by anyone else. Now, this logic about transcendent duties and correlative rights may no longer be understood in civil society at large, and it's even to a good extent been lost sight of within the church. But I think it is an argument that still must be made, as in many senses it is the last witness to the truth and moral nature of God to a society rapidly losing its moral bearing. Of course, we must continue to keep this understanding alive within our church and institutions. If not, we will face an increasing disconnect between our biblical teaching and our own members' and young people's sense of natural justice, which is easily shaped by the standards of our society and culture. But by drawing on a little history, I think we can show that these current understandings are not the only ones out there, and in fact, not the ones to be embraced as Christian young people.